to the OnScript podcast, your home for world-class conversations on scripture and theology, where you get to meet some of the best in the field. Visit us at onscript.study. Say hello on Twitter at onscriptpodcast and stop by our Facebook page at facebook.com/onscript.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the OnScript podcast. This is Matt Lynch coming to you from Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia. And we hope that you've had a good Easter holiday. And we're back with another fantastic episode from the one and only Dr. Irvine Shablatsum. And he's got some really groundbreaking work that he's going to be discussing in this episode. I would definitely say sort of buckle your theological, biblical, scholarly safety belts and be prepared for a pretty exciting ride. So we're always so grateful to have him on. And in the spring, in the late spring, early spring, sorry, and just to continue to learn from him. I've learned a lot from him, and I know a lot of our listeners have as well. So if you'd like to support what we're doing because or in spite of this episode, then you can do so by going to onscript.study/donate or share the word, what we're doing here with your friends. Maybe friends that have never heard a theological podcast before would appreciate one of our other episodes. Okay, well, enjoy the episode, and thanks so much for listening. Okay, welcome back, OnScript listeners. Our guest today needs little introduction, but for those who don't know him, we've got Irvine Shablatsum with us. He has a PhD in science.
Doctor.
Yeah. Dr. Irvine Shablatsum has a PhD in science and theology. He's the author of numerous books, including Paul, Multiverse Theory, and The Journey of the Inner Soul, Fault Lines in the Horizon, and the book we're discussing today, Abraham's Bosom, Paul and the Decline of Postmodernism, published on Amazon.com. So
what? .co.uk, .car, and .d. International now, my friend. International.
Yeah. Well, welcome back, Dr. Shablatsum, who also has the Center for Excellence in the Lake District in the UK. And yeah, well-known around the world. It's so good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, so good to be back together. And I'm really excited to talk about your book, Abraham's Bosom. How's it been going with you recently?
I think I need to tell you a story. It's time for a bit of a mea culpa. Where I live in the Lake District, we have a high volume of young people, I would say, probably more than we need, but high volume nonetheless. And one of them came a knocking. They did some dolly knocking, 11 o'clock.
Wait, what's dolly knocking?
Oh, that for you lot, for the North Americans. Maybe ring and run, ding dong. Ding dong ditch or something like that. I think you yeah. So
okay. So dolly knocking or ding dong ditch. Yep.
Yeah. So knock on the door, run away. Oh, how funny! How original. So one of these ones, you know, did it the other day, and I thought to myself, you know what? Even though I've got a number of pending legal cases, I can't let that go undealt with, should we say? So I jumped up, got out the house, put my slippers on, got out of the house. And clipped my phone to my belt, saw where he went. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to dolly knock you back yourself, get you right back. So I ran up to the house. I thought, you know what? I'm going to bang loudly because you need a shock. You need a bit of an education. You need a wake-up call. And so reached back. Down came my fist to give that door a great big knock. Unfortunately, that very second, an old lady opened the door and I smacked her in the face. These things happen. Long story short, ambulance, police, all the rest of it. Unfortunately, clearly, and as you know, being a scholar yourself, when you're dealing with the police, you can be articulate and clear, and they still don't quite understand what happened. So I felt they didn't understand fully. I even tried to draw them a diagram, but they didn't seem to want that. So they basically, anyway, let's just say, as the saying goes, I had my day in court. And although Doris was kind of understanding about the situation and the complexity of what went on, the judge obviously found that maybe I was a sort of liable. You know, maybe she could have ducked, not saying anything, but, you know, anyway. So, she's 84. She can, you know, she's got some, you know, anyway. So, yeah, fair enough. Mea culpa. I should do my punishment, do my time. Send me to the clinker, send me down, put me in the joint. The judge felt that the most appropriate action was community service. So I don't know what you call that in America, whether you don't go to prison.
We say community service.
You have to go and,
yeah.
Great. Well, you understand, then that's good. I sometimes don't think you understand, but this is nice to have some things that we can understand, which is great. So community service. So the judge felt that it was appropriate that he said that I sort of probably didn't understand the youth of today. So there was one of these things where you can go and have a meeting with a social worker and the police. They get together, people who have, maybe made mistakes with young people, and the young people can have a chance to explain to them what life is like for a young person in this modern age. So I thought, you know what, this is Matt.
What's that? Parole?
An opportunity,
yeah.
No. Well, we don't have parole, but anyway, yes, an opportunity. Mm-hmm. This was a prime opportunity for another work. So I thought, you know what, this is an opportunity. Don't look at it as a punishment. You hardly did anything wrong. Let's focus more on what this is, and this is an opportunity.
And I think that's what I really appreciate about you and your approach to life, and I think what our listeners really appreciate is that your ability to turn almost any situation into a research project. What happens. And I think that's the kind of spirit we want to cultivate here, is that no matter what happens to you, you can do research on it.
Yeah, I think some scholars think research comes after reading lots of books, looking in articles, visiting historical sites, going to conferences or all that kind of stuff. No, step outside your door and there's right in front of you could be the greatest opportunity of your life. It could be a real canon event.
So where did this lead in your research? So your book is called Abraham's Bosom, Paul and the Decline of Postmodernism. So how did that come about? What's the relationship to what happened with the Dolly Knocker?
So I'm now in the community center, picture it if you will. And I thought, you know what, when you meet with people, my methodology, my historical, theological, sociological, anthropologetic method is about being the subject. So I thought, I need to understand these young folk. I need to get into their shoes. I literally got into not the kids' shoes, but the shoes that these people wear. So I went on the internet, did a bit of Googling, as you do, and I discovered a website and a brand, because like I said, brand's important, a combat brand. And I found a brand that's popular amongst the young people, and that's called Lululemon. So quite a lot to increase my riz.
Is that spelled Lululemon? Is that?
No, it's more, I think you've got to go Lululemon. So it's kind of, I think the extenuation is like on the mon.
Probably French.
Yeah, like French, yeah. Oui, oui. So I needed to increase my riz because I wanted to be taken seriously. So I went and I got my riz level up, which was great. And then I went there and I met these young people. I opened with some of my thoughts, as you can imagine, and it didn't go down very well. One of these young people called me a boomer. I smiled. I was like, thank you very much. They all laughed. So I was like, hold on a second. I think when you say boomer, I'm thinking someone who booms their voice, like they've got a loud voice, an authoritative figure. I'm a boomer. It's not. So I put on my readers and I got out my phone, unclipped my phone off my belt, Googled it, and it's not what I thought it was.
So your book, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so we will move on to my book. Mm. You need to understand the historical journey these kids have been on, right? They have now reached and have been absorbed into postmodernism. That's what came across to me. These are postmodernistic mules. They carry postmodernism on them like a mule. And I'll come back to that. So my book, Abraham's Bosom, Paul, and the Decline of Postmodernism is this exploration of this idea that some generations fall into their pre-modernism, postmodernism, pre-postmodernism. That it goes through phases, doesn't it? It's modernism. I think we're in a post-postmodernist stage. So I hope that has made it absolutely crystal clear why the book is called what it's called.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I get it.
With you the whole
way. I get it.
Yep.
So
part one of your book is entitled The Problem. And you gave a subtitle to that called A Wolf in the Chicken Stock. And you talked about it, how it exposes the nefarious ingredients that go into postmodernistic culture. So What are some of those ingredients that you've noticed in among as you studied the youth, as you did research, as you traveled? What are some things that, you know, let's diagnose the problem of postmodernistic culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'll do that now. Oh, you want to pack it now? Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yep.
Well, in the framework of my book, I think for me, one of the key things is two things. Okay, the key thing is behavior, language, and attitude, right? How you behave, the kind of language you use, and your attitude is a measure of which part of the postmodernistic world you've decided to land in. And so I'll just randomly pick a group of in society, a demographic in society, yeah? Let's say they're kind of like early 20s, right? Let's start with them. They've got their own language. They've got their own way of doing things. I mean, as an example, is it easy with examples, do you think?
Yeah. Let's drill down and talk about this culture. Like, what are its characteristics?
I want to keep, let's take a postmodernistic example of this. Music on the bus. If I was to want to listen to your music on the bus, on the way to the supermarket, but you know what I would do, Matt? I'd knock on the shoulder. I wouldn't make any physical contact with anybody. I would gently approach somebody and say, "Excuse me, sir, your music is amazing, but do you mind that the whole bus doesn't want to hear that?" So that is an example of that person slipping into postmodernistic culture. Do we need electronic scooters on every street corner in this country? No, we don't. Why? I don't know. You're a historian, Matt. Do you know when the belt was first discovered?
No.
Somebody invented trousers. Surely a week later, somebody invented the belt, right?
Exactly. You got to keep
them up. Young people not wear? What's with this postmodernistic demographic not wearing belt? I don't want to see your pants.
Yeah.
What do you guys call?
That'd be underwear for
underwear. I don't see your underwear. I don't care if they're from Calvin Klein. I don't want to see them. Pull your trousers up. You know.
Yeah. Good examples. So you know, paint the picture a little broader. What are some other things that you've noticed in postmodernistic culture that you wanted to address in terms of the research you were doing? Because some of this is in the church too. So where do you see it? Like, because part of your book is talking about how postmodernistic culture has infiltrated the church. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, I think children rebelling against their parents. That is something that I think parents, I know I'm not a parent myself. I do have chickens. So I'm able to understand, I think quite easily, how to manage chickens. You don't see my chickens running wild, screaming at the top of their voices on the bus, do you? No, you don't. So why can't parents stop that happening? As an example, my chickens have not gone into the postmodernistic world, so there's no reason why children need to. Okay, the sense of entitlement that this demographic has as well, the mind boggles, Matthew. The mind boggles.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Right.
I mean, his prime example, right? And I understand. And again, I'm not a parent. I get that, and I don't want to poo-poo parents. I'm sure they'll do a good job. But the baby's crying thing. In church, if we look at the Bible, when we look at the tabernacle, there was no creche in the tabernacle, was there?
No, that's a good point.
The priests were like, let's hang the curtain and put the creche out, were they?
Yeah, and some of the other things you mentioned in the book were babies that cry too much and demand too much food. You talked about people wearing hats inside, and greedy children. So, you know, a lot of these sound like your critiques are aimed at a particular demographic, namely kids and youth. Is that intentional? Is that what you're aiming at with this book?
What I'd say is that when you put a number of different, I'm going to go a bit sciencey now, so I hope your followers can keep up. But when you put like water, olive oil, and some other substance in a glass, they separate, don't they? And one comes to the top. And for me, this is the one that floats to the top, children and young people and youth, the youth kind of thing. You know, these people, these are the why, you know, they're like floaters. They just come to the top and they just seem to be the ones that have chosen these behaviors, like whispering in church. Yeah, I get you 5 years old, but don't whisper. Do you know what I mean? I get you 4 years old, don't giggle. Surely by the time someone's five, they should be able to not giggle in church. Just as an example. Because I think, do you know what? The giggling, the crying, the whispering, the giggling, 10 years later, do you know where they are, Matt?
Where?
They're on the bus playing music. I think I could track that back. And that is the slippery, that is what I call the slippery slide to postmodernism.
Yeah, I mean, without doubt. I mean, I think that you've made a good case that there are a lot of serious problems in culture. like, what would you say are the cultural and philosophical, theological roots of these problems?
I think these small people have their behavior is deeply rooted in a postmodernistic thinking. I think they've been exposed, overexposed.
And what? How would you define that postmodernistic thinking?
Three words: me, me, me. You know, I know it's awkward because I know, like, don't get me wrong, society can't bend its will around you. Not you, Matt. I mean, like, the demographic and the core of the book. So this draw towards the postmodernistic thinking, the deeply rooted postmodernistic thinking, is why there's a chapter I've got in there about the problematic roots of postmodernism.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
So for me, I mean, I'll just do a little excerpt from the book. One of the most well-known postmodernistic concerns is postmodernistic concerns is deconstruction of theory, philosophy, literary criticism, and textual analysis developed by Jacques Derrida. Derrida's work has been seen as rooted in a statement found of grammatology. Il n'y a pas de hors texte. That, for all our non-Spanish listeners, is there is nothing outside the text. Just let that sink. There is nothing outside the text. Derrida's philosophy inspired a postmodernistic movement called deconstructivism among architects, characterized by the design that rejects structural centers and encouraged decentralized play among its elements.
Wow.
Let me simplify that for your listeners.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but I'm sure some of them need this. You can't live in a house that you've taken apart. I am here to declare that the great house of deconstruction needs to fall. Mainly due to my research, what I've managed over the last few weeks at the Center of Excellence, I feel we're on the precipice of making the great house of deconstruction to fall and open the doorways to the great house of construction.
Hmm, that's good.
The next phase.
So you've talked about the wolf and the chicken stock. The cultural trends you're seeing, the philosophical roots of it.
Absolutely.
Let's get deeper into the critique. All right, the next section of your book is called Five Smooth Stones, where you say you take down the giant, quote, just like Jonah did when he struck the whale with stones.
Absolutely.
From his thing. So let's talk about Paul, because Paul's in the title. What are some ways mm-hmm. that you have found Paul to be helpful in slaying this whale, so to speak, of postmodernistic culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, everyone knows my work of Paul, and I do. I do really think Paul was the CEO of this kind of thing, as they say, as the kids say. Paul, right? Where did he live? He lived in an ancient culture. Okay, that ancient culture was sometimes called antiquity. You know, he didn't seem bothered by that. He embraced. He wrote letters by hand. He traveled by boat. He probably walked a lot. Didn't need e-scooters. Didn't he? Didn't he need scooters everywhere, did he? Didn't travel on the bus with his music blaring, did he? You know? And he was certain about things. He knew that he could write a letter, get on a boat, and travel.
So part of your point then is that Paul, is his life is a critique of postmodernistic culture because he lived different one and he was comfortable with that.
Absolutely. So that one. Oh yeah, just to his life, his works, his travel, his personality, it was a push against postmodernism the whole time.
And you dropped a very interesting word in there, the word certain. And one of the points you make in the book is about certainty. So talk about that a little bit and where you find that.
Right. Talk about epiphany. You know, like I used to think that, you know, part of me used to think before I was a proven scholar like yourself, Matthew, I did look at you guys and thought, gosh, I bet that's a lot of work, you know? But now I'm in the club. Sometimes I'm like, this is easy. You know what I mean? It just comes to you, doesn't it? You're just sitting at home.
I wish.
You know, chilling out. Maybe you're doing something wrong. Because for me, right? Biblical support from Paul. Yeah? Listen to this. Get your ears around this. As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, again, Macedonia is a country in Australasia. As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, stay there in Ephesus. This is 1 Timothy 1:3 for all you scholars listening. As I urged you when I went to Macedonia, stay there in Ephesus so that you may command certain people not to teach false doctrines any longer. What word jumped out at you there, Matt?
Well, you emphasized the word Macedonia.
Okay, let me try again. As I urged you when I went to Macedonia, stay with the Ephesians and so you may command certain people not
the to word teach certain any longer. Jumped out.
Yes, exactly. Doesn't it not just jump off the page at you?
Yeah.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So he is saying through that, in my humble opinion, certainty is key. Postmodernistic is building your house upon the sand. Boom. Done. I mean, don't, everybody, please go and buy the book. Don't just think that's it. There's more to it than that. But that is, you know.
Do you have any other biblical support?
Oh, you're a proper scholar, aren't you? You want two sources. Wow. All right. Easy peasy. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to float down to Corinthians now. What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? Certainly not in this matter. 1 Corinthians 11, 12, 22b. What jumped out at you there, Matt?
Certainly.
Certainly. Does it again. I think anytime that Paul uses a word twice, he's signaling to the reader, this is important.
That's subtle. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So maybe we'll move on to the next part of the book then. And this part is called Shiblatzim's Alternative. And then what your alternative is called Abraham's Bosom. So,
absolutely.
So that brings us really to the central part of, you know, the heart of the matter. How did you come to this idea?
I don't know what you need to even ask, Matthew. Let's simplify it for your audience. Let's mooch on down to Luke. All right, Luke 16, 22, 23. Let's see what jumps out of you in this one, Matty. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off, thus Abraham's bosom far off, and Lazarus at his side. So you've got three things there. You've got Abraham, Abraham's bosom, and Lazarus, all in the same place. And the poor man who died in Abraham's bosom. So the post-modernistic culture, these people, you know, on the bus, playing their music, e-scooters, you know, these guys, it's not really, that's not Abraham's bosom, is it? First, as you describe Abraham's bosom, you wouldn't go, it's a 14-year-old on the bus playing music loud that no one wants to hear. Buy some headphones, you know? Whereas a bus where everyone's silent, no one's making eye contact, that to me is more of a, I think Paul would see that as Abraham's bosom.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dramatic contrast. You know, you have on the one hand, Hades or hell being in torment and then Abraham's bosom. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying then is that postmodernistic culture is essentially hell.
I would say post-postmodernism is more of a Hades vibe. I think if we're going to be vibing somewhere and these postmodernistic entomological behaviors that I have documented, I think they do lean more towards deserve to be in Hades and that kind of an environment than kind of the bosom end.
And one of the things you note is that you said, I'm quoting here, Abraham's bosom is a refuge from the chaos and hedonism of postmodernistic culture. And you talk about three different things that go into that. So why don't you take our listeners through those three ingredients, those three things that really comprise Abraham's bosom?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the things you need to have to create Abraham's bosom, if we're going to talk about it, not factually, but in a kind of methodological way, is depth of thought. Like just for example, just a random example, like kind of my book, you know, that's kind of a good example of that. You need an element of science. You know, science is the grease that oils the wheels. We've too quickly abandoned this in the postmodernistic culture. I mean,
and that, you know, we haven't brought up Dave yet. Who's your colleague? For those of you who aren't familiar with him, he's your right hand man.
Hold on, that's Dave. No, give me a sec.
Okay.
Speak of the Dave.
Okay.
Okay. I'll call him back. It's right. Dave. So I can give you a quick Dave update.
I mean, we're still talking about science here, so I'd like to hear what he's working on at the Center for Excellence.
I mean, I think what the mistake a lot of scholars and some of your listeners may be scholars that make is they don't do enough experimental with science. I think science is pushed slightly to the side in this. So what we've engaged in is we're kind of in a direct science project, is what I call. So Dave's spending time now. He's focusing on raising backyard goats. Again, some of the kids, one of the postmodernistic things that happens is synthetic clothes. And I think one of the things that you, one of the things that draws you towards a postmodernistic culture is things like well-fitted, well-designed, fashionable, comfortable, affordable clothes. And that's not really the description given in Revelation, is it?
Okay.
I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. And the whole moon turned blood red. Don't focus on them. I think we should not focus too much on the kind of language around sackcloth made of goat hair, because my point is about goat hair. So my feeling, this kind of part of Revelation is really a way for us all to grow and really focus on things like that. So the choice is for the postmodernistic person, they're going to wear like a tracksuit or some jeans that don't fit properly just to look cool. Whereas why not have and wear a sackcloth made of goat hair to reject the postmodernistic culture?
Yeah, I mean, that would make a statement, yeah.
Can I finish?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we are going to launch a fashion line of goat hair clothes.
Oh, wow. Is that an announcement?
Yeah, that's an announcement. So right now, we are, you know, it's very fashionable, not just in the way it looks and its cut, but also like people at the moment think that global warming is important. You know, they think that, you know, maybe you shouldn't wear clothes all the time or whatever. So we can goat hair, natural clothing, natural byproducts. We're going to wait till the goats die a natural death and then skin them and then make the clothes. And that way, that for me is like, you know, as the science, I found this article online about the, I think it's described as the circle of life. And it's about how animals in the wild, particularly in the Serengeti type area, live together. And they have quite complex relationships, some of these animals in the Serengeti. And so, but their motto as a collective is the circle of life. And so I think being able to create a natural line of clothes with that mantra based in it is just fantastic. Did you know that time never stands still? For no one. So what's after the now?
The then.
Yes, then being the future. I then move forward. I then lift my foot and step forward. The future. Two things for the future: AI and Bitcoin.
Wow. Okay. So,
or as I like to call it, Bitcoinal. So that's the merging of Bit and Coin and AI. So Bitcoinal is really helpful here. That's something we are focusing our time on. So when Dave's not breeding and feeding, he's AIing and Bitcoining. So that's how he divides his time.
So what are you doing with AI and Bitcoin if you're able to share?
So we've started a project. So what I've realized, but there's one of the things that seems to be solving people's problems now is something called crypto. So we've gone into that. So Dave has been able to source us some funding to start a crypto AI blockchain platform that enables us to find the critical, to enable us to be critical of the postmodernistic culture to move the whole culture forward.
So you secured the funding for that? That's great. Not an easy task.
Yeah. No. And we've been able to find some local investors, angel investors, for anyone in there who does internet startup type stuff, like me and Dave, you know what that is. So we were able to secure an angel investor local to us, which is great news.
Fantastic. Big shot, yep. British investors.
Well, it was, in the end, it was Dave's mum. We got turned down by a few people, but that doesn't dissuade us. So in the end, we turned to Dave's mum. She's taken money out of her house for us, which is great. So, I mean, she's elderly anyway, so, you know, that's that. So that's our seed money. So, yeah, we're going to take AI, merge it with crypto, and suspend it by the blockchain. That's the plan we've got so far. So, yeah, so this 50 grand is going to be, you know, more. We're going to take successful postmodernistic songs, movies, things like that, things that really speak to that culture. And then we're going to use the AI crypto suspended by the blockchain to suck out the postmodernistic ideology that is entrenched in this kind of popular culture type stuff.
So you could take like and a movie, that, like a popular movie that has postmodernistic ideology and you sort of debug it, so to speak.
It's a de-postmodernistic technology. So you'll end up, and the product that comes out will just be, dare I say, we'll be able to make these things and into Abraham's bosom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you write in there in that section in the book where you're hinting at this. You say people often talk about the web or the cloud, but you're talking about the bosom. So you're really talking about a whole new way of doing culture and technology.
I know the irony is I'm on a podcast when I say this, but I hate to talk about this. But sometimes, and again, I know, and I mean, I don't make this awkward. I mean, I know where you are in your career. I know what your published number of books are and stuff. And I think you're really doing a good job, Matt, and you're really making a good attempt at the scholarly stuff. But I don't know if you know what it feels like to strike gold, you know, in all honesty. And so, I wouldn't be surprised if in a year's time, everyone's talking about the bosom. So we've had web, we've had the cloud. I think next is going to be Abraham's bosom. You know, I think that's going to be the next stage for us. But you can put your money where your mouth is. You've got to prove it. So you've caught me, you know, like, I mean, there was a point when Michelangelo was sculpting David and half of him was a block of marble still in the top half, probably. I don't know. You probably start from the top where you went, haven't you? So he's kind of like, you know, half done. Doesn't mean it wasn't great. So greatness is here. We just need to finish the statue. So maybe by next year, by this time next year, we'll have
good comparison.
Finished.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you've got a lot going on. You've got Dave there working with you and he's bought in on working on this project.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things, you know, like, I don't know whether you're an Old Testament scholar, aren't you?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, like, I can imagine you sitting at home, dressed in original antiquity outfit, reading Leviticus. I imagine you just get up and you start looking for mildew, or you wonder about sacrifice and stuff like that. It's hard not to be touched by the thing you're studying. So I think, you know, I've had to have a word with Dave. I mean, he felt that halfway through the first part of the project, he started raising some concerns with me. And he said he kept saying, this is not about postmodernism. This is about fairness. And I think he was confusing it. So, for example, he wanted to get paid for working for me, for example. He thought it would be good to have other views. He thought we should critique my ideas and things like that. No. So to me, I'm sorry to say, I think Dave got too close to the fire, like the guy with the wings, you know. He got too close to the sun. I don't blame people for being like this, you know. I can see the traction towards living a postmodernistic lifestyle. And so, you know, I had to word with Dave and, you know, we tried to correct it and stuff. You know, he won't shut up about the getting paid thing, but I think, you know, right, we all want higher pay, you know, or payment for work, whatever, but, you know, got to be disciplined not to be sucked into postmodernism, you know. As they say, the grass, you know, can be green.
Yep, it's true. It is a good reminder that we all are susceptible to postmodernistic thinking.
Be on guard. I think you've got to just wake up and be on guard to it. You know, like I tell you what, the other day I did, it caught me out. I was in the, Dave was taking me down to the, to doctor's appointment. He was driving me down there and in his mum's car. And the radio came on and there was some postmodernistic music. Right. And
you probably wanted to turn that off.
Well, this is it. You see, before we turned it off, I started tapping my feet. I was like, my body started moving. And I was like, what is going on? So there you go. People like me who have an unbelievable understanding of things like postmodernist culture and the effect it has on individuals, particularly individuals under the age of 25, even I feel I can be susceptible to it. So you really have to be careful, on your guard about these things.
You know? What would you say to the critique? Unfair, to be sure, but what would you say to the critique that, like, oh, all you're doing is taking everything you don't like with youth or with, you know, cultural trends and calling them postmodernistic? How would you respond to that?
This is how I do. Okay, that's it. I would say, when the wolf is at the door, don't answer the door.
Yeah, that's helpful. I think that kind of leaves us in a really, I would say, a sober place, but an important place for reflection.
And again, you probably never felt this, Matt, but when you fall on something that's going to have such a dramatic impact on society, I think that you have to do the thinking afterwards. So it's kind of, for me, it's called post-thinking. So if you do your thinking, you have your idea, then you've got to think about the thinking you've got to do next, which is called post-thinking. So my post-thinking around postmodernism is that we've done pre-postmodernism, we've done post-premodernism. So because no one likes to be in the unknown, don't they? You know, like Paul says, certainty is key, isn't it? So what I've done is I've come up with a new mechanism to hold this idea of what's next, and that's postmodernism. So it's both pre and postmodernism. It's called postmodernism. It's like a holding modernism. So it's a modernism for hold now while we wait for the next modernism to come out. I mean, I'm sure there'll be another one soon. I mean, here's a thought experiment as a way of trying to understand the complexity of coming up with new names for stuff. If you were to, so thought experiment. So if your audience is listening, if you just close your eyes, unless you're driving or operating heavy machinery or a bicycle or something, if you're sitting on your sofa or lying in bed, close your eyes. Think about everything you've ever seen and heard.
Okay.
Point made.
Yeah. Wow. That's hard to do.
Hey, it's hard not to be sucked into postmodernistic culture.
Yeah, you know, you talk in the end of the book about, you know, what you've done, what you've accomplished in the book and in your research, which, you know, I can't imagine the hours it took. Where have you landed? Where is this headed?
I think the easiest way to explain that is to say it like this. If a ship leaves the harbor and sails out to sea, the ship is traveling, it's on a journey, but the destination is unknown.
Sure.
The destination is only known by the captain. I think that's all I need to say.
Right, unless they tell their crew, right?
I suppose, yeah. If they tell their crew, then their crew would know as well. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Sablatsum, I mean, this has been a fantastic interview, and I really appreciate our listeners appreciate getting to hear about Abraham's bosom, Paul, and the decline of postmodernism, and the way that you're taking us past this culture that, in many ways, has gotten us stuck. And I think a lot of youth, a lot of people that are listening to this will feel like maybe your book, maybe this conversation has gotten them a little bit unstuck. And I think that would be...
I mean, I wouldn't say this, Matt. I really wouldn't. But I think other people, I can understand why someone might say this about me. I do wonder whether my work is moving towards being the key to unlock the log. I wouldn't say that. I'm not one for that kind of thing to say, but I could see what other people would say that about my work. So I suppose, like the saying goes, watch this space.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Sablatsum, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with OnScript, and we'll look forward to your work again around this time next year.
And as always, Matt, my offer stands that if you'd like me to come on as a host of the platform, the door is always open.
Yeah, I'll be in touch.
Now, like, I literally mean that. If you do want me to come on, I'm happy to come to do it. So just let me know.
Well, yeah, sounds good. All right,
give me a call, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah, you can call me anytime. I mean, you can just or email me. You can email, call, or write me a letter or whatever, you know.
Great. Well, thanks so much, and we'll...
Yeah, great.
We'll be in touch soon. Thanks.
You've been listening to OnScript, delectable conversations on scripture and theology. If this episode has brought you inner peace or lit your biblical fire, please consider a small donation of just $2 or $5 per month. Information on how to donate can be found at onscript.study/donate.